Now, even before the rise of the nation state in the West, to which we shall come, Italy had had a kind of peculiar position in Europe. For Italy, unlike the rest of Europe in the Middle Ages, had presented a modern rather than a medieval aspect. What do I mean by that? Power in Italy had always centered in her towns and cities. And unlike the rest of Europe, towns and cities had never declined there as they declined in the rest of Europe. In Italy, instead of the countryside dominating the towns, such as there were, in Italy, the towns dominated the countryside. Moreover, these cities in Italy not only dominated the countryside, they had gotten throughout the Middle Ages a great measure of political independence. And they had gotten that in a rather simple way, which I just mentioned in parentheses, namely by playing out the emperor against the pope. Situated between the territories of the pope and the territories of the empire, they had played out emperor against pope and become, by and large, independent city-states. By 1500, these were independent city-states in central and northern Italy. But not only did the cities dominate the countryside, not only did they become independent city-states, but they also came to play a central economic role. These Italian cities, or communes, as we call them now and then, were the bankers and middlemen of Europe during the early stage of the evolution of commerce and trade. They were therefore economically important as well as politically independent. Now, these Italian cities developed rather rapidly in the 16th century. The growth of cities everywhere in the 16th century was rapid. Rome, for example, doubled its population from some 50,000 in 1500 to some 110,000 by 1600. Florence rose very rapidly to some 70,000 people. Cities were growing very rapidly in the 16th century, in the north as well as the south. And their importance was fully realized. For example, in these politically independent and economically strong Italian cities, you have for the first time town planning. The idea, for example, as early as 1500, to separate pedestrians from horse traffic by arcades, which you can still see in most Italian cities to today. The replanning of old cities, especially the replanning of Rome, all of this was already starting, which gives you an idea how important cities, Italian cities especially, were thought to be. Urbanism then was advancing in the whole peninsula, but not merely there. In Northern Europe, they were advancing as well. Now, this kind of urbanism is the setting for the Italian Renaissance. But in order to understand it better, we must look for a minute at the development within these politically independent city-states. For their history was remarkably similar. From a republican form of government in the Middle Ages to a despotism in the Renaissance. By 1500, most of these independent city-states had become despotisms. The Medici in Florence, the Visconti, whom you will read about in Genoa. Sometimes they were outright despotism, and sometimes they were a commercial oligarchy. Now, why this evolution? Why this evolution at all? And here we must be clear that in these towns, nearly half of the population lived on the poverty line. That is to say, in our modern terminology, nearly half, and I would say about half of the population of every one of these communes lived on the poverty line. And as a result, city politics tended to be explosive. Bread riots by the poor became traditional, you might say almost respectable, in the 16th century. These riots were always tinged also with religious fanaticism. The results could be very nasty, as we shall see, not only in Italy, but in Paris and in the north as well. Now, in Italy, these riots by the people living on the poverty line gave the despots their chance. And their chance came in two ways. First of all, many despots or would-be despots allied themselves with the poor masses of the population. And in an alliance with the masses, were swept to power, which they were then able to consolidate. Other despots used the riots to call in foreign troops and to establish themselves through the foreign troops. The Visconti of Milan are the great example of this. At any rate, these two ways, the despots managed by and large to dominate and to establish themselves all over Italy. And by 1500, there was scarce a commune left. Moreover, internal dissension was bound to weaken the structure of the city. The despots, for example, the first thing they did is offered, of course, bread and peace. And then they destroyed the free republican institution of the city, above all the trade guilds. They destroyed them fairly early on, and the trade guilds, the trade associations, had been the bastions of what you might call the powers of the commercial classes in the cities themselves. Now, what can we say about these despots and these despotisms? We can say, first of all, that the despots developed in a vacuum of political tradition. There was no political tradition on which the despots could base themselves. The Middle Ages didn't know any despots of this nature. And therefore, there was no tradition that feudalism, or indeed Christianity, could offer. The despots were self-made men and ruthless. They had no tradition, no hereditary principle. They maintained themselves, quite obviously, by bread and circuses. And they furthered art and literature for their own glory. A lot of Renaissance artists like Leonardo da Vinci got their start in designing, as you might call, public spectacles for the despot, designing for the despot public spectacles for his own grandeur. He had no hereditary principle. He was, so to speak, thrown upon his own. That must be clear. Now, if this was true, secondly, the result was, of course, and this is very important for the Renaissance, a decline of the civic spirit. We'll see how Machiavelli laments that next time. A decline of the civic spirit. And the great political issue in the towns of Italy came, how can you get a renewal of the civic spirit, which had declined? For the intellectuals, this decline of the civic spirit seemed typical of degeneration. The kind of despotism seemed typical of a society which was slipping into degeneration. And they blamed the despotism very largely on traditional Christianity. They said the whole society is corrupt. Look what's happened. Our free institutions, or what we think are free institutions, have been destroyed by these despots. They have made an alliance with the disfranchised masses. They go in for bread and circuses. They have disenfranchised us. No longer any elections. No longer even a citizen army. None of that. A mercenary army. We have been totally disenfranchised, and that means a degeneration, a decline. For to political disarmament, if you like, went military disarmament. Mercenaries took the part of the citizen army. And the mercenaries, of course, were loyal to the despot, not to the city or anybody within the city. They were loyal by whom they were paid, and that was the despot, not the city. The result was a general quest for renewal. And it is out of this political situation that I've tried to describe that the intellectuals began to cast around in Italy for a general renewal, a renewal of society, a renewal of politics, a general moral renewal, because they blamed the despots also on moral decline. Everything was in decline. Morality, politics, and so the renewal had to be a moral renewal and a political renewal. It is under these circumstances that the intellectuals in Italy begin what we call the Renaissance, for they called it the rebirth. They wanted a rebirth. What they did, as you will see in a minute, was not really having a true rebirth by the fact of doing something entirely new. But out of that quest for rebirth, the quest of renewal in their cities, which seemed to have degenerated, comes a new political attitude, a new moral attitude, and indeed a new attitude towards culture in general. For what happened actually, as I said to you, they were politically disarmed, the commercial classes and the intellectuals. They were militarily disarmed with the mercenary armies. Therefore, their idea of renewal became centered upon art and literature. Their whole sense of belonging, their whole sense of patriotism, which is involved, the patriotism for the city, the patriotism for the city-state, all of this came centered upon art and literature because they were excluded from politics. They were excluded from military affairs. They were, in other words, disarmed, and art and literature became, as it were, the instrument of renewal. Thus you have the fact that Petrarch was crowned poet amid universal acclaim. Thus you have the tremendous involvement in artistic competition, such as the famous competition for the baptistry doors in Florence. The famous baptistry doors in Florence. For these weren't merely artistic competitions in our way of looking at it. These were competitions towards a renewal of morals and of society, and all of this came into art and literature as the one terrain, the one territory in which you could still work and work meaningfully when politics and military affairs were out of your hands. Now, what came out of all of this, in a sense? If there is this displacement into art and literature, the longing for renewal, renewal which, and let us be clear about this, would make for new political participation. What came out of it? They looked for models. Now, this must not be surprising. If you live in a time of where you think everything is degenerating, where society and morals and everything is degenerating, and you want, if history doesn't oblige you and you want to make history oblige you, what do you look first? You look for models, right? Che Guevara. Well, if I may say so, they had a more applicable model. They looked to classical sources. That was their model. Classical sources. For they blamed Christianity for this general decline, too. They looked for classical sources, and what classical sources? Above all, the Roman Republic, for here was an ideal kind of model, a republic which had not yet declined, a republic where everybody participated in its politics, a republic which produced great works of literature and great works of art. They looked to the Roman Republic, not, of course, to the Roman Empire, but to the Roman Republic. And the Roman Republic became their inspiration. Now, let us get one thing right. These people never wanted merely to imitate the classic. They used the classic as inspiration for a contemporary renewal. In fact, it is the people of the Renaissance who first got what we would call a sense of historical distance. Just as they were the first to invent perspective in art, to to invent perspective in art. So they were also the first to get a historical distance. Past and present was for many of them no longer telescope. What they developed on the basis of Rome was a critical attitude towards their own institution. A critical attitude, you must look at it that way, a critical attitude towards their own institution on the basis of the ancient documents, on the basis of the ancient Roman culture, the ancient Roman documents. Thus, for example, you will read about Valla, one of these intellectuals, back to them in another way in a minute, you will read about Valla, Valla, who, on the basis of ancient documents, discovered that the papal claims to rule Italy were in fact a forgery. That famous discovery of Valla's, that the papal claims to rule Italy rested on a forgery, was or illustrates just what I have tried to make clear to you. The classics were in a way an inspiration. They were used to develop a critical attitude of mind. Now out of this idea of renewal, out of this idea of taking the classics as your model to develop a critical mind, came attitudes which we must now describe as more modern than medieval attitudes. Attitudes which pushed Europe ahead, as I've told you before, which were part of pushing Europe ahead. What came out of it? I can only mention these things very briefly, and you will fill them in your own reading. First of all, what came out of it, because of the concern with culture, was a renewed stress upon the beauty of nature and, as we say, the importance of man. But that needs qualification. For neither nature nor man was stressed as something of itself, but nature and man were the handiwork of God. In your source book, read very carefully Petrarch's letter to Boccaccio. Read very carefully Petrarch's letter to Boccaccio. And you get the idea that nature and man were important, but as the handiwork of God. These people were not rationalists, and they certainly were not secularists, as the 19th and 20th century defined it. What they rejected was Christian theology, and they rejected it in favor of an idea which lies close at hand if you want to renew society, an idea close to what we call pantheism, which is simply two words and means, in fact, pantheism. God is everywhere. The idea that God is everywhere. You don't need an intermediary. God is everywhere. In the leaf of a tree, everywhere around you is God. And what you have to do to renew morals and society is realize that God is everywhere around you. However, how was God typified? God was typified not in theology, but rather, and here we come to the classics, but rather in a new sense of beauty, in a new sense of beauty and purpose. That is how God was typified. These people were still concerned with the immortality of the soul, but they went to Plato above all, for Plato is a pantheist in that sense. They went to Plato, and from Plato they drew a concept of beauty, which does put man in the center, but not as man himself, but as a reflection of God. Now you have seen, I am sure, Renaissance paintings, one sort or another, and you will see that the Renaissance painters still use Christian motifs. They painted the Virgin Mary. They painted the various stages of the life of Christ. They painted the various saints, but they painted them with something else in view. The saints are symbolic. Not so much of Christian theology, but they are symbolic of a new concentration on the beauty of man and the beauty of nature. But you may say, this is very vague. What is beauty? What is beauty to one is ugliness to another. But the Renaissance had a very definite idea of beauty, which they got from the classics as well. Beauty was proportion. They got that very largely from Plato, but from others too. Beauty was proportion. The beautiful man or the beautiful woman was that man and woman which had the right kind of classical proportion. And in order to find that out, they began to study biology. They began to study anatomy to find out the proportions, which were the proportions symbolizing the harmony of human proportions. And the harmony of human proportions symbolized the beauty of man. And the beauty of man was a direct reflection of God. Now, to be sure, all of this became an ecstasy of beauty and love. Dante, Petrarch, all the others made a sort of game of making groups of the prettiest women in town. Dante, for example, counted 60 women in Florence who had the most beautiful proportion, whom typically enough he formed into what he called a heavenly court, because these women with these real proportions, of course, were a direct reflection of God. Public discussions of the idea of love were common, and notaries filled their dull transcripts with doodles of lyric poetry. But this love was what we call Platonic love, an expression that you may have heard, maybe not either. Platonic love, for it is not a love based on sexual attraction so much, but rather on a theory of beauty, proportion, and a reflection of God in this world through man, which would lead to moral renewal. And moral renewal would carry with it the renewal of all and society. For the beauty of women and men, which the Renaissance people sculptured and painted, you must have seen some of it, sculptured and painted, were a means of national regeneration. Just as much as writing in the secular tongue was a means of national regeneration. All cultural activity was a means of national regeneration. Here, read in your source books Dante's defense of writing in Italian. When you read in your source books Dante's defense of writing in Italian, keep in mind again that this was to be a matter of national regeneration. National regeneration, therefore, to summarize it, through culture in a society where everything else has gone to pot. So national regeneration, children, this is nothing new. I don't always want to refer forward, but if you have read the writings, let us say, of somebody who's very popular today, like Herbert Marcuse, it's very much the same thing. Renewal through cultural regeneration, because everything else seems to be hopelessly involved, hopelessly outside you. And you hope that that national regeneration will lead eventually to a political regeneration. Now, secondly, the intellectuals who pioneered this have a name. They are called humanists, and at these we must look a little closer. They are called humanists, obviously, from the word man, the Latin word man. Now, who are the humanists who pioneered this? They are intellectuals concerned with just that kind of revival of classical values, not as imitation, but as inspiration, which I have talked about. They were intellectuals concerned with a revival of moral values, which would lead to a revival of political ethics. They believed moral values and political ethics had gone wrong under the Christianity of the Middle Ages. And the result of this going wrong in the Dark Ages, it's these humanists who called the Middle Ages the Dark Ages. Petrarch was the one to coin the term Dark Ages. And the last outcome of the Dark Ages was the despot, who had destroyed what Italy had had in civic spirit and in free institutions. These men, therefore, were not merely interested in editing classical manuscripts, in collecting libraries, which they did, but they wanted to revive the totality of classical life in order to renew the totality of their society. The classical virtues came to outshine the Christian ideas, which have seemed to have failed in the corruption I have mentioned so often. So what happened? Christian piety is rejected. There is no piety. What is important is devotion to parents and to country. What is important is devotion to parents, but above all, the civic spirit. What is important is action, either cultural action or political action, but not contemplation. Not contemplation. Obvious. What is honor? Honor is no longer a Christian ethical concept, like the concept of chivalry in the Middle Ages. It's no longer the concept of chivalry, but it is a concept of personal glory and illustrious deeds to fulfill yourself. To be sure, this went to excess, this idea that honor is to make illustrious deeds to fulfill your own inner needs, to fulfill yourself. This could go and did go to excess, but still, it is a redefinition. And in the end, what is important is not the Bible, but the classical purity of style. Petrarch, for example, believed, and so did they all, that the purity of the Latin style would indeed lead to a moral renewal. Now the importance of this movement, the importance of these intellectuals, are easily summarized. This is, in a sense, the first secularly oriented movement in Western civilization. What do I mean when I say this is the first secularly oriented movement in Western civilization? I mean this. These people believed in God. They believed in the immortality of the soul. But they put man, man's beauty, man's capabilities in the center. For the reflection of God is man. Is man. Virtue is no longer the Christian virtue, but virtue is arrived at through man himself, man acting on the basis of the classical examples. This is what we mean. These men accepted the present. They wanted an ethical society, but they believed in the last resort that if you had a moral regeneration. In this manner, they were still very Christian indeed, by the way. If you have a moral regeneration, you will also be able to overcome despotism and come again to the civic spirit, that these things are, after all, connected. Finally, the humanists were optimists. For their idea of man was not only that man is the reflection of God in a pantheistic, if you want to be technical, Platonic world, but their idea went further than this. It is that man is basically good, capable. Because the whole thing doesn't make any sense. Otherwise, what they above all rejected from Christianity, with Christian theology, was the idea of original sin. They rejected it. At best, they minimized it. And so, they had one other great belief, the belief in education. That through education, centered on what? Centered on cultural activity, centered on the classics, obviously, for reasons that I hope I have made clear, that through education centered on cultural activity, centered on the classics, you could indeed reform man, and through reformed man, reform indeed society. The result was that the humanists founded schools all over Europe, the best schools, from St. Paul's School in London down to the schools in Italy, the best schools for a long time now are schools founded by the humanists, schools in which most other figures we should deal with were educated, with one exception, typical, Martin Luther. All other figures were educated in humanist schools, got their primary and secondary education. Schools which stressed the classics, obvious. Schools which also stressed to a large degree the arts. The result was the ideal Renaissance man, an ideal of man about which I don't want to say anything more because you will read it in your source book with Castiglione, The Courtier, the famous book called The Courtier, and you will read it in your source book, which puts forth the ideal Renaissance man who will fulfill all the things that I have mentioned. Man then is perfectible, but he can only be perfected through learning. And there's one thing about this that I want you to notice straight away. This is a doctrine of intellectuals. This is the doctrine of the humanists. It equates perfection and learning, because you have to know the classics. It equates perfection and learning. It equates its optimism with what you would call a kind of cultural elitism. The result is that this humanism was, in a way, a Sunday dress, and that vast majority of the Italian population did not take part. That the vast majority of the population still lived in the universe, which I have talked about before. But at times, the two universes came together, the universe of the humanist and the universe of the vast majority of the population whose millenarianism I have tried to explain to you last time. The most famous episode, about which I must now speak, in the Renaissance, where these two things came together. And you can see that there are no sharp breaks in history, really, of this nature. That all that I have told you today is the new attitude of mind, but it coexisted with the old. It's an episode in Florence connected with the monk Savonarola. That episode is worth looking at for a minute. Again, you will read about it in greater detail in the Barnes book. Savonarola, between 1494 and 1498. What happened? What happened? Florence was besieged. The French king, Charles VIII, had invaded Italy. An event of the first magnitude, as you will see, in political history. But for, let us say, the Florentines, an event of the first magnitude as well. An event that was to them intensely frightening. And so Savonarola, who had been a monk preaching in the dome in Florence, made a prophecy. He said that because Florence is directly under Christ, therefore Charles VIII will bypass Florence. He won't besiege it and sack it. Charles VIII bypassed Florence. And Savonarola, through this prophecy, which worked out, became, for these years, the dominating force in Florentine life. Now, here you have an interesting combination. For Savonarola typifies the kind of prophecy that I talked to you about last time, the kind of prophecy which appealed to 16th century Europe and to medieval Europe in times of stress. Savonarola prophesied that eventually the Antichrist would be slain and that Charles VIII was kind of a harbinger of the evil which would come before the good. The kind of thing I tried to explain to you last time, which is involved in the millenarianism in these kind of prophecies. He prophesied that. He prophesied that Charles VIII was the Antichrist, who would cleanse the church. And the church cleansed would mean, remember, the second coming of Christ. But what do we find? We find the humanists supporting Savonarola. And we find Savonarola supporting classical learning and the humanists. And we find, therefore, existing side by side in Savonarola, very typical, the kind of millenarian and prophetic ideas which I talked about last time, which were the ideas of the vast majority of Europe on the one hand. And on the other hand, we find the sophisticated humanists believing in all the things that I've just told you about, supporting Savonarola. Savonarola failed. Eventually, it came crashing down. But that kind of thing will not vanish. And you must be clear about that. Savonarola's Florence was an experiment. An experiment to build the new Jerusalem, to prepare one piece of the earth where Christ would come back, to prepare the new Jerusalem. There'll be a second experiment, an experiment a little later in 1534, which we shall deal with, but which I want to mention now, the experiment at Münster in Westphalia to have another city be the new Jerusalem. And this will never die out, for you may have sung in church, some of you, especially in Presbyterian churches, a very famous hymn which dates from that century, this century, and is sung to this day, to build Jerusalem on England's green and pleasant strand. In England, you have the same kind of thing that you had in Münster in Westphalia, that you have in Florence, that you would have everywhere. The great millenarian urge to get out of the present, not by the humanist route of learning and education, of optimism about man, but by the route of, if you like, the book of the Apocalypse, the route of prophecy, by the route of first having Antichrist and then the second coming of Christ in the millennium. I need not tell you that it is the second, that is the revolutionary dynamic in with European society, and not the ideas of the humanist. That must be clear. So that, to return to Savonarola's Florence, you have then side by side heightened religious sensibilities in the millenarian vein, cleansing, purification, prayer, fear, second coming of Christ, side by side with humanist activity. The answer to the tensions of life came from both directions. But the humanist direction was the direction of the intellectuals, and the other would be the direction of what we may say popular culture. You will see that reflected everywhere. Martin Luther will come out of millenarianism, out of popular culture. And John Calvin, as you will see, will come from a sophisticated urban humanist environment. And therefore, their ideas will be quite different on quite different kinds of base. Now, to summarize then what I have tried to tell you, perhaps in three parts, I will do this a certain amount. Eventually, I will give up all this summarizing. I am making very great efforts not to make things too simple for you. Because otherwise you think life and history is simple, and then you will become a millenarian before you know it. And that's something I really don't want to be guilty of. So I am not trying to make it too simple. First of all, the Renaissance then comes out of a real political atmosphere, which I have tried to make clear. That secondly, it pushes thought ahead from the Middle Ages, or let us say in a different direction from the Middle Ages, through the idea of renewal on the basis of the classics, through the rejection by and large of much of traditional Christianity, always remembering that these people were neither rationalists nor secularists. Thirdly, what they wanted, of course, was a revival of the civic spirit, a revival of participation, and in that they believed in education, above all, in education. It was an intellectual affair. Fourthly, am I there? I can't.
can't count, so sometimes I'll get this wrong. Fourthly, you mustn't make things too exclusive. Look at yourselves. I bet a lot of contradictory things exist in yourselves. Well, people don't change much, by and large, through history. I know there is an idea which comes out of bad biology that environment changes people fundamentally. I should have think living in the post-Freudian age, we wouldn't really believe this. But still, lots of things within people, a lot of contradictory things exist. And therefore, as you can see in Savonarola's Florence, what exists side by side is the heightened religious sensibility of popular culture and this elitist ideas of the intellectuals, but the intellectuals shared popular culture. An awful lot of humanists who believed in signs and portents, humanists believed in astrology, humanists believed in alchemy, humanists believed even in prophecy, like Savonarola's and medieval prophecy. These things exist side by side. They are not always exclusive. You mustn't make it too sharp. Now, in all of this, the contribution of humanism, I think, is quite clear. Man was educable. The beginning of modern education is here, too. But who was to educate the people? Humanism was elitism. That must be clear. It's very concentration of learning. Rulers were needed to educate the people. And the monopoly of the church on education must be broken. Now, these are the changes out of which comes, finally, a new view of looking at politics. You can say that today I have dealt with new views of looking at man himself. That's what we've been talking about today very largely. New views of looking at man himself, not secular, not rationalist, don't always read history forward. There was no rationalism, there was no secularism until the 19th century. There was no market economy either until the 19th century. Don't always read history forward. That's a terrible thing to do. We must get in and see what these people actually meant. And what these people actually meant, therefore, was a new view of man, according to Plato, rather than to Christ. But still, a view of man which has a predominant place for the divine. That we must not forget. But out of this came not only a new way of looking at man, there also came a new view of looking at politics. And that new view of looking at politics is, of course, so relatively important because it did become the new politics that we must devote a whole lecture to it. For the man with whose name it is linked is, of course, Niccolo Machiavelli. And Machiavelli wrote under just those circumstances. He wrote at the time when the civic spirit had declined in Florence. He wrote at a time when Florence was, and then definitely went under, the rule of despots and all that it meant. He wrote at a time of the invasion of the King of France into Italy. He saw all of this. And out of all of this, and because he was a humanist, he tried to apply humanism to politics. And what he came up with has, of course, vitally influenced the view of politics from the 16th century to this day. Now, is there anybody here yet who has not filled out a card? Please go and see Mr. Silverglade at the end of the room.